The title of my message today is The Problem with Money. And I can almost hear some of you saying, the only problem I have with money is that I don't have enough of it. But actually, that is probably not true. You probably have more problems than you realize, and this section from Ecclesiastes chapter 5 will help all of us to understand that, because the truth is that we all have exactly the right amount of money, because we all have exactly what God has chosen to give us at this time in our life. And therefore, the problem is not that we don't have enough of it, but the problem is that we don't always have the right attitudes towards it and the right management of it. We do not always handle it correctly, often do not handle it correctly. And so for that reason, we are happy to be able to return to Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and take up the last portion of this chapter in verses 10 through 20, having covered the first chapter, or the first portion rather, some weeks ago. You remember, I trust, that Solomon is writing the book of Ecclesiastes to give us the benefit of an extended period of investigation that he undertook throughout his lifetime, namely to investigate the various elements of life and to determine which of those elements contribute the most to satisfaction with life upon the earth, to learn what it is that produces earthly satisfaction, produces happiness, satisfaction with life. What is most important? Is it knowledge? Is it wealth? Is it sensual pleasure? Is it the accomplishments of labor? Or is it something else? And though we are still not quite halfway through the book, we are already beginning to get some answers to these questions, because we have already learned that actually it is none of these things if pursued apart from God, and it is all of these things if pursued putting God first in our lives. All of these things to the extent that they are submitted to God and regulated by His Word. And so today we're actually returning to the subject of money, which was previously discussed in chapter 2, but there are a lot of things in chapter 5 that were not included in chapter 2. This is not repetition. This is addition. And so the problem with money, and I have two parts in our portion for today, and that is, number one, a catalog of problems with money, verses 10 through 17, and number two, a healthy perspective on money, verses 18 through 20. And in this section, Solomon, by the Spirit of God, gives us a catalog of many of the problems that accompany money. Not all of them, to be sure. I'm sure there are more problems than this. But these are some of the main ones. Money cannot satisfy. Money multiplies expenses. Money deprives of sleep. Money encourages hoarding. Money promotes isolation. Now, those are the five problems with money that Solomon deals with in this section. Let's look at them a little more closely. Money cannot satisfy, and that takes us back to verse 10, where he writes, "He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase." This also is vanity. He uses that word vanity again, which is used nearly 40 times in the book of Ecclesiastes and is obviously one of the key concepts in the book. And yet, because it is not always understood in the way that I think Solomon intended it, we sometimes miss some of the important elements of this book. But you remember that vanity is a word in the Hebrew that simply means vapor or mist. And therefore, the meaning we attach to it depends on how we understand that concept of vapor and mist. Does Solomon mean by using that word that everything is futility? Futility, futility, all is futility. Some have thought so. Does he mean that everything is mysterious and difficult to understand, like trying to peer through a fog, through a mist, and cannot see things clearly? Is that what he means by the use of that word? Or does he mean that everything in this life is fleeting, it is temporary, like a mist, like a vapor, it appeareth for a little while and then vanishes away? Well, those are three very, very obvious possibilities, and so we can't assume that futility is the primary meaning, as normally is thought when this word is used in the text. And here, he probably means something more like fleeting, that love of money is a fleeting matter because life is fleeting, as he will make clear as we move along in this text. But what he's saying when he tells us in verse 10 that money cannot satisfy, he's saying that money can never satisfy for a number of reasons, but one of them is because when our goal is money, the goal keeps moving. You never reach the goal. That's the problem, because you make money the goal, money your primary object in life, money it becomes in essence your God, then you never know when you have enough. You set a goal, perhaps. Some people set goals, some people don't. But some people set goals, and I'm going to work hard, and I'm going to invest, and I'm going to be diligent until I have X number of dollars, and you get there, and you say, well, that's not enough. I need more. So then I'll keep working at it until I get X more number of dollars, and you get there, well, that's not enough. I need more. And that happens all throughout life. The goal keeps moving. Those who love silver are never satisfied with silver. Those who love abundance are never satisfied with the abundance which they have. Money can't satisfy because the goal keeps moving. The second problem is that money multiplies expenses. The more you have, the more you spend. The more you have, the more you have to spend, at least to some degree. Because when you have a lot of things and the expenses of what it takes to manage that, manage your investments, manage your property, there are the expenses of what it takes to protect these things. You can't just leave them out unprotected. You've got to make a lot of provision for how to protect them, how to insure them, how to secure them, how to keep them locked away from those who would take them from you in one way or another. And there are a lot of expenses involved in that. And as Solomon points out here, when riches increase, then those who eat them also increase. Whenever you have more, somehow, there always seem to be more claims upon it, more dependents that need help. And because you've got money, and how can you turn away particularly relatives of yours that need help? It's hard to just close the door on them. And so the more you have, the more people you have to hire to help you, those are more dependents. The more people that want help from you, and before long, all of that extra doesn't seem to be benefiting the one who produced it, who worked for it, who was wise in managing and brought it about. In fact, Solomon indicates that in many cases the owners lose control of their money, at least full control or their sense of control. It gets to the place many times like all they're doing is just standing there watching all of this abundance which they produced and everybody else is utilizing it. All they can do is just watch it happen, because money multiplies expenses. Number three, money deprives of sleep. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. The older I get, the more I realize that sleep is one of the greatest blessings of life, and sleep is one of the greatest problems of life. It really is. Nothing better than a good night's sleep. Nothing more frustrating than a bad night's sleep. I didn't sleep very well last night. I was up several times when the lightning was flashing and the rain was going on. Someone else told me they weren't even aware of it. Good for you. Thank God for your good sleep. I was very much aware of it. I was up and down a number of times last night. I didn't sleep that well. It seems to happen more as I'm progressing on in life. Not quite sure why that may be so. I saw one of these game shows on television the other day, and the question they asked was, on a scale of 1 to 10, how well do you sleep? And the first answer was 2. This was a fairly young man, a lot younger than I am. And they asked somebody else the same question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how well do you sleep? And the answer was 4. That's still not very impressive. And then when they gave the average of all the people they had polled on that question, the average answer was 5. It doesn't sound like very many people in America are getting a good night's sleep, for all kinds of reasons, but one of them has to do with money, the problems of money. Money deprives of sleep. Maybe because America is truly one of the wealthiest nations in the world, it also turns out to be one of the nations where people have the greatest trouble getting a good night's sleep. Could there be a relationship between the two? Solomon suggests that there very well may be. He actually talks about two different categories of people here, the poor man and the rich man, and he says that the sleep of the working man is generally good. And these are broad generalities. This is not true in every case. I'm sure there are working men who have aches and pains and infirmities that make it difficult for them to sleep. I'm sure there are working men who have a troubled conscience, who wonder when the husband of the woman that he's committed adultery with is going to come knocking on his door, and so forth and so on. It's not automatic that because you are a working person that you're going to sleep well. But in broad generalities, he says that the working man tends to sleep well because he labors hard, and hard work and physical activity helps get a good night's sleep. He often eats a simple diet because he can't afford an abundance of food and expensive foods, and so a simple diet actually helps a good night's sleep. And because he has fewer possessions to worry about and take care of, he often gets a good night's sleep. What would you rather do, be the rich man who can't sleep or the poor man who can? Makes you wonder if that was really worthwhile to work so hard to accumulate all of those riches. The sleep of the wealthy man, again in broad generalities, is often difficult and inadequate. The very abundance that he has accumulated hinders his sleep. The expensive food that he's so easily able to afford often hinders his sleep. We may understand more about that in our day than they did in Solomon's day, but so often the more expensive foods, the richer foods, the more delicious foods are the very ones that keep us up half a night. And lack of physical activity. The rich man doesn't have to work because he can afford to hire other people to work in his place. And so he doesn't because he doesn't have to, so he doesn't sleep well because he hasn't done the physical activity that will enable him to get a good night's sleep. And probably more than anything else, the complexities of his life. All of the things that are required for him to care for his possessions, to manage them, to secure them. The excessive demands of all the things that he has accumulated cause him to worry more than he should because he's got more to worry about than the poor man does. It causes him to fear more than he should because he fears being deprived of these things, of losing these things, because, and the poor man doesn't because he doesn't have much to lose. And so money oftentimes deprives people of sleep. Well, there's another problem, number 4. Money encourages hoarding. Now again, it doesn't have to any more than money has to deprive of a good night's sleep, but these are the things that money tends to do. Money encourages hoarding, and that's his verses 13 through 16. And Solomon tells us that riches can be hoarded harmfully, and riches can be lost suddenly, and riches will always be lost eternally. That's a summary of the verses here in verses 13 through 16 that we'll look at now. Riches can be hoarded harmfully and often are. There is a severe evil, said Solomon, which I have seen under the sun. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt. In other words, saved excessively. And Solomon calls this an evil, a severe evil. They are kept to his hurt. Now we have the general idea that saving is better than spending. Saving is good, not bad, though most people, though they know that, seem to have a lot of trouble doing it. Saving is better than spending, but I like spending better, so I do more spending than saving is the attitude that most people have, I think, toward this. But here we are told that saving can be excessive just as much as spending can be excessive. And we don't often hear that. We hear a lot about spending being excessive because that's a more common problem. I read just recently that the number has gone down in America. Back in the before the recent economic downturn several years ago, I read, and I don't know who keeps these statistics and knows these things, but I read that the average American was spending something like 120% more of his income every year, 120% of how much he was bringing in each year. He was spending every year. Now that number's down, thanks to the recession, the economic downturn. Now it's only like 107%. But the average American is still every year spending more than he takes in, which means what? There's only one thing that that can mean. The average American is going a little bit further in debt every year, every year, every year, every year. Excessive spending. He's always spending more than he has, more than he makes. So we do understand, I think, at least theoretically, about the problems of excessive spending, but do we understand about the problems of excessive saving? Solomon's talking about that here. That's one of the problems of money. A severe evil. The implication is that this one who keeps his money, rather, he keeps it to his own hurt, the implication is that he does not spend it when it would have been wiser to spend it, and he does not give it when it should have been given. He doesn't spend it when it would be wiser to spend it. When I thought about that, I thought about a man I knew many years ago, about 40 years ago or so now, a wealthy man, but very tight with his money, built a beautiful home in a beautiful neighborhood, but refused to put in central air conditioning because that cost extra money both to install and to run it. So in sweltering heat, he and his family suffered in their beautiful, expensive home without central air conditioning. And when he came to sell it, nobody wanted to buy it. Didn't matter how beautiful it was and in what beautiful neighborhood, who wants an expensive home without air conditioning? Now that was really smart, wasn't it? No, that was dumb. That was failing to spend when he should have spent. Wisdom dictated that that would have been a prudent expenditure at that point in his life, but his hoarding instinct, his miserliness made him pinch the pennies and hold on to it and not spend when it would have been wiser to spend. And don't even talk about giving. So riches can be hoarded harmfully to his hurt. But riches, as Solomon reminds us, can be, and many times are, lost suddenly. Riches are very uncertain. He said, but those riches perish through misfortune, and when he begets a son, there's nothing in his hand to give to his son. Now, Solomon is not saying this always happens. He's saying, I have observed this happening on some occasions. Somebody working hard and saving every penny he could and accumulating and saving and accumulating and saving and refusing to spend or spending as little as he could get by with and giving nothing away, and then bang, one day it's all gone. Bad investment. Failing business. Somebody stole it and it's gone. And then where's the benefit of all of that scrimping, saving, investing, working hard, burning the midnight oil, losing sleep, managing, scraping? Gone. And he's instantly as poor as the man who never did any of those things. Maybe even poorer. That can happen. Riches can be lost suddenly. Very, very suddenly. That's exactly why Jesus said in Matthew 6:6, I've got, it's on two pages here, so I've got to get both pages to get the beginning of it, in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 6:19, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. On earth, there is always the potential for it to be lost. Money that is invested in heaven by being given to the Lord, given to his causes, will never be lost. That's secured permanently, but riches that are held on to his hurt, oftentimes disappear. They're gone. Riches can be lost suddenly. And then verses 15 and 16 of this section are telling us that there's one step beyond that. Even if riches are never lost in this life, and they're not always, some people manage to keep them to the very end of their life, but riches will always be lost eternally. Nobody can take one dime of what he accumulated with him when he dies. He's going to go out of this world with exactly what he had coming into this world. Zero. Zero in, zero out. Doesn't matter what you've got in between. But when you leave, you lose it all. Every bit of it. Not one dime goes with you. Only that which you sent on ahead of you will be there when you arrive in eternity. Riches can never become a permanent possession. Riches cannot be retained beyond earthly life. All riches are lost eventually, whether they're lost to a bad investment or to theft or whatever in this life. Riches, all material possessions, what Solomon is saying is, are entrusted to us for this life alone. They are to be utilized in this life. Your Heavenly Father knows you have need of all these things. He will give you the things you need for this life because he knows what life consists of and what it requires. These things are entrusted to us for this life alone. Therefore, it's important that we learn to manage and allocate them wisely while we are still alive. Because the day we die, we have lost all control over them. We don't take any of them with us, and we can't control what happens to them then. Somebody else will have them. And then they've got the same cycle all over again. How are they going to manage them? Wisely or unwisely? What are they going to do with them? So money encourages hoarding. And then the fifth problem of money is that money promotes isolation. Verse 17. All his days he eats in darkness and has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Money tends to develop in the person who has it, particularly when they're handling it improperly, social problems and emotional problems. Social problems. All his days he eats in darkness, that is, alone, without companion, without joy, because he's pushed people out of his life by his miserliness, by his orneriness, by his lack of social skills, because money was his god, and he never valued learning how to act as a good citizen ought to act in relationship to other people. That wasn't important to him. So it is, as life goes on, closer and closer, down toward the end, there generally becomes more and more isolation. And not only social problems, but emotional problems. He suffers much. He has much sorrow and much sickness. This much goes with all of these. And much anger. In other words, excessive sorrow, excessive illness, and excessive anger. All goes with money that has not been received and handled and thought of in a proper way. He suffers much. He has much sorrow, or that word is also translated vexation or irritation. He has more vexations, more irritations in life than anybody. And often has more sickness. Isn't that interesting? You'd think he's wealthier. He can afford the best medicine available. You'd think he'd have better health. He can buy the best food. He can buy the best medicine. He can go to the best doctors. He can go to the best hospitals anywhere in the world. He can have better health than anybody else. But usually, again, broad generalities, usually it turns out that he has more sickness than anybody else, because all of these worries and cares and the way he is mishandling his money cause all kinds of pressures and stresses on him that cause him to be sick. And anger. He has excessive anger. He lashes out at people. He is so intent on preserving and protecting his gold, which is, it turns out in so many cases, has really become his god, that he sees people that he thinks are threatening it and trying to get it who really aren't. But he lashes out in anger for all kinds of reasons and in ways that sometimes it's hard to figure out why that set him off or her off. But there it goes. And so he has social problems and he has emotional problems. What Solomon is describing here is a lonely, bitter, irritable person. A lonely, bitter, irritable, rich person. Doesn't sound like that wealth did this person very much good as far as what makes a satisfying life, what makes a happy life, what makes our days on earth, however many days we have under the sun, happy and satisfying. But then Solomon moves on, secondly, to a healthy perspective on money. And that's verses 18, 19, and 20, and I'll read it again. Here's what I have seen. Well, first, verse 18. Here's what I have seen. That's how he opens this section and reminds us that this, again, is a result of his investigation and observations. Here's what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. Here's what I've seen, based upon observation and investigation. It is good and fitting for people to enjoy the good things that God has given. That's good for people. Good for you, good in the sight of God. This is fitting, what you should do. It is suitable. Suitable for earthly life and in keeping with God's design for life. And what is this? It is to enjoy what God has given. That's good. That's fitting. That's suitable. That's pleasing to God. That's approved by God. That is in keeping with God's design for your life, believe it or not. And he breaks that down, enjoying what God has given, into two categories. First of all, the laboring man, and secondly, the wealthy man, just like he divided that earlier in the passage. So first of all, for those who are not wealthy, he just gives this advice. It's good to eat and drink and enjoy the good things all the days in which he toils under the sun, the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. That's oft-repeated advice in the book of Ecclesiastes. It comes up 4 or 5 times throughout the book, basically the same statement, again and again and again. It's obviously important, and it must be something that people have a little trouble understanding and applying. But he says, it's good, it's pleasing to God for you to enjoy the fruit of your labors. And some of the greatest enjoyments, according to Solomon, are those that relate to the simple pleasures of life. Being able to eat and enjoy your food, being able to drink and enjoy it. Again, if you're sick, you don't do that. If you have digestive problems, you don't do that. How many people could afford anything they wanted to eat and they have to eat oatmeal? They can't digest anything else or whatever they can digest. What a shame, what a pity. But how common that is, actually. How good it is to be able to enjoy the simple pleasures of life. the enjoyment of eating food and enjoying it, the enjoyment of the simple pleasures. Food and drink is just an illustration to cover all the simple joys of life. The joys of the outdoors and enjoying what seeing being in God's creation and breathing in fresh air. The joys of family and children and grandchildren. The simple pleasures of life that don't depend upon being wealthy. They're available to anyone if they're able to understand them, utilize them, receive them, have the right attitude toward them, if they are enabled by God to enjoy them. Enjoy them as long as you are able. That's what we are told for those who are not wealthy. Accept material provisions as the reward of your labors in life. That's what he calls it in verse 19. To receive his heritage. As for every man, go back to verse 18. This is what I've seen. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good things of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. Some translations translate that Hebrew word, that is his lot. That is his allotment in life. This is what God has given to him. You can see how that, the idea of heritage, this is what God has given to you as your heritage. Some translate that reward. This is your reward in life, that God rewards you with, because of your toil and hard labor, God rewards you with a measure of good things for you to enjoy in life. Enjoy the fruit of your labor. That's for those who are not wealthy. Then he goes on and says virtually the same thing for those who are wealthy. Verse 19. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage, his lot in life, his reward, his inheritance, what God has decided to bestow upon him as a heritage, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. Now, what is the gift of God for the wealthy man? Well, the gift of God is the things that God has given and the ability he's given you to be able to work for and acquire these things and to produce them. That's God's gift to you. But just as important, don't miss this part of the verse, God is the source of your ability to enjoy the things that you have. God's the source of your wealth. God's the source of your ability to enjoy your wealth. You can have all the wealth in the world, but if God doesn't give you the ability to enjoy it, it becomes tasteless and tedious and burdensome and irksome and irritating and problematic and more of a burden than a blessing. Both the things that God gives and the ability to enjoy those things comes from God. If you've got the things but not the ability to enjoy them, then you might as well not have them. In fact, they're more of a liability than an asset. But if you can take the things that God gives and have the God-given ability to enjoy them in a God-honoring, wholesome way, that is of inestimable value. And what's the key to being able to do that? And that's the gist of verse 20, which is a little cumbersome, but I'll read it and then I'll explain it to you. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. What this is saying is that for those who focus more on the giver than upon the gifts, you understand what I'm saying? Focus more on the one who gave the gifts than on the gifts that have been given. A lot of people don't even recognize that any of them actually came from God. I did that. I worked hard for that. That's mine. I did that. I have nobody to thank for this but me. Sorry, you're wrong. You're wrong factually. And that attitude is going to render it impossible for you to enjoy these things that you're so proud of. But then there are people who know that God gave them, but they still don't focus more on the giver than on the gift. God gave them, and I'm going to hoard them. I'm going to make them my goal in life. No, don't do that. Focus on the giver, not the gifts. In other words, the person that does that will end up not dwelling, and here's what verse 20 is telling us, not dwelling on the hardships and trials of life. Rather, because he's rejoicing so much in God's goodness, focusing upon the God who gave them more than the things that are given, then the inevitable sorrows, difficulties, and trials of life that we all have recede into the background. They become less a part of his life, less of a factor. When you focus on God with gratitude, sorrows recede. But when you focus on self and things, either the things you have or the things you don't have and want, when you focus upon self and circumstances and the things that other people have, then you don't understand why you don't have them. But you're focusing on things. When you focus on things, sorrows increase. That's the point of verse 20. When you focus on God and rejoice in him, and the things that he gives are a secondary issue, then sorrows recede because your life is all caught up in your worship of God, your service of God, your focus on God, your learning about God. You're finding your greatest enjoyment, your greatest satisfaction in God, the giver, more than the things that he gives. But when you push God out of the picture and you're focusing only upon this life, the circumstances of life, the things of life, all of the things that God grants, then what happens is that all the sorrows of life grow. They get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and you end up not enjoying anything. Isn't that interesting? But that's the truth. Old Solomon's got a lot of wisdom here, doesn't he? You think the book of Ecclesiastes isn't profitable? I think it is eminently profitable. It is in the category of wisdom literature, of which you find Proverbs and other books in the Old Testament, and you can see that there's a lot of wisdom here, an awful lot of wisdom here that God has given to us for life and how to enjoy the life which God has given. So here's the conclusion. I am driving to a conclusion now. Accept what God has given and enjoy it without worshiping it. Give God first priority in order to enjoy the things he bestows. Seek God, not pleasure, and God will give you true satisfaction. Or another way to put it is God will give you pleasure. When your highest pleasure is God, then you can find a lot of pleasure in the lesser things that God gives because they're all in proper perspective. But when you are seeking pleasure in these things instead of in God, then you end up not deriving any pleasure from these things. You can't. Now I'll close with three lessons that I will give you, and then we will be done. Number one, a lesson about earthly enjoyment. Accept joyfully and comfortably whatever God bestows. That's a lesson we need to learn. Make neither things nor austerity your God. And though most Americans and even most Christians in America don't have this problem, there are a certain percentage who do. Usually those who are more committed to the Lord, and sometimes to the extent that they're uncomfortable with the thought of enjoying anything that God gives. Really. It's all austerity. I can't have anything extra. If God gives something extra, I've got to give it away. Well, I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But that's not the attitude that I find here. And what happens with folks like that, in my observation over the years, and confession, I've been there and done that, and I've had to learn better what the Bible actually teaches in this regard. But what happens to folks like this is when they do indulge a little bit, as they almost always do, they can't really enjoy it fully because they always have to rationalize it and justify it and tell people why it was they really had to buy that car that they really feel in their heart they probably didn't have to buy, but they did anyway because they wanted to and because God had provided it for them. But now they can't really enjoy it because they feel guilty about having something that's a little nicer than what they're accustomed to. And so then they've got to explain to everybody why it was they bought that one and why it was really needed, instead of just go ahead and say, it's an indulgence. God gave it. Isn't God good? I'm going to enjoy it. Is that wrong? No. According to this, that's exactly right. Some of you have trouble with that. Most of you don't, but some of you do. But make neither things nor austerity your God. It dishonors God as much to refuse to enjoy his kind gifts as to worship the gift rather than the giver. We all understand that worshiping the gift more than the giver is a problem. We have to struggle with that many times. But do we understand that refusing to enjoy with pleasure the good things God gives can be as dishonoring to him as refusing to worship the giver as more than the gift? I assume that was an appropriate comment. I couldn't hear it. Yeah. Now let me give you a New Testament text that says exactly the same thing. In 1 Timothy 6:17, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches. So you don't make riches your God. You don't trust in those. Not to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who gives us, here we go, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. That's got to be a mistake. It's got to be a bad translation. We can't have anything material to enjoy. Yes, if you do it right, with the right perspective, you can. So here's a lesson about earthly enjoyment. Secondly, and this I think has to go with it to keep it all in the right perspective, here is a lesson about giving that we learn in all of this. How do I know what I can legitimately enjoy? Because if we're conscientious about it, we know we've got a covetous heart. We've got to be careful that we don't start worshiping things and finding pleasure in things instead of in God. So how can I know what I can legitimately enjoy? What God really has given me for me to enjoy instead of for me to give to others, to invest in the gospel, to lay up in heaven. What has God given me that I can actually legitimately, in a God-honoring way, enjoy in my life on earth under the sun? How can I figure that out? Well, when you are giving generously of what you have been given, when you are giving God the first fruits of what you have been given, when you are managing your money appropriately and not going into debt, you can know that the extra is probably given to you to enjoy, or to be a little more specific. And here's where I think, and I've mentioned this to you before, but I say it again, here's where I think the concept of the tithe is very helpful. I know the New Testament doesn't command tithing, but when it comes to figuring out when I am being God-honoring by refraining from spending and investing in God's kingdom directly, and when it's legitimate for me to indulge a little bit and enjoy some of the things God has given, there aren't very many objective ways to figure that out. Is that totally subjective? Or, since we've got this standard of the tithe all the way through the Bible, before Moses, and even some minimal references to it in the New Testament, which I'm not going into now, but since we've got this general standard of giving, if we consider the tithe an objective standard to help gauge our attitude toward money, if we are doing that, if we're tithing and giving beyond the tithe, and God still has given us more than is necessary for our needs, then it's probably God-honoring to make that purchase and enjoy it, to splurge a little. But if you are only gaining what you have by running up debt, only gaining what you can by not giving to God, by holding back on your giving, you're not tithing, you're not giving generously beyond the tithe, then you are probably not ready to splurge. You need to work at this a little bit more until God brings you to that place where you can legitimately splurge. I'm going to illustrate this with a personal illustration. I don't do this very often, but I'm going to. Many years ago, my wife and I determined that we were going to quit making car payments and start buying cars with cash. Now, the day we decided to do that wasn't the day that we were able to do that. We had to work toward it gradually over a period of time, and I'll explain that in private if you want to know how. But we've been doing that for quite a while now. And when we bought the previous automobile that my wife was driving, the very next month, she started putting money in savings for the next one as she was driving this one. And we talked about it then. I said, when you've got X number of dollars in the bank, then you'll have enough money to buy your next one. And I forgot about that. I totally forgot about it, but she didn't. Several years went by. She came to me one day and said, I've got X number of dollars in the bank. I want to buy a new car. My first response was, not brand new, you know, new to us. My first response was, oh, there's nothing wrong with your old one. Keep driving it. Keep driving till the wheels fall off. Keep saving. Now it makes me uncomfortable. It's got too many dings and scratches and dents in it, and it doesn't look good anymore. And I know it's running good, but it's too old. By then it was, trying to figure out here, 12, 13 years old or so, and had a lot of miles on it. Mechanically as sound as it could be. The dealer told me so, where I take it for service. He said, this car will last you another 100,000 miles easy. So, is it legitimate? Well, I know that she tithes faithfully. I know that she gives beyond her tithe. I know she saved many thousands of dollars over the years in her car fund. Is it legitimate for me to say, nope, it wouldn't be God-honoring for you to buy a new car? I think it's more God-honoring to say, this is one of those things that God has given. God has supplied it. You can do it in an honorable way. Help yourself. Let's go shopping. That's the idea I'm talking about. Now I conclude with this statement about salvation. You cannot be right about money until first you're right with God. You can't be right about money till first you're right with God. And you can only be right with God through His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. Because ultimately, what I'm talking about in all of this is, it's all about worshiping Him. If you're worshiping Him instead of things, things fall into place. But if you're not rightly related to God, you can't do that. So you're worshiping things instead of God, and you'll experience one or more, probably many, of the problems with money that are listed in this catalog here. Christ must come first. Go to Him, shall we pray? Father, thank You for the wisdom and helpfulness of Your word. Help us to apply it to our lives in a God-honoring way, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.